All right, great. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Asher bachar banu mikol hamim V'natan lanu et torato Baruch atah Adonai Notein haTorah. This week we begin Parsha Shmot and also the book of Shmot, the book of Exodus, and we are on page 292. So as everyone gets to it, we will begin. The ideas from our class today are taken from a wonderful shiur that I listened to from Rabbi Abba Wagensberg that I thought was just really wonderful. So we're going to start out, and as we know, the Jewish people, we ended the book of Bereshit, the book of Genesis, with the death of Jacob, and the Jewish children, Jewish people are down in Egypt, and then everyone passes away, and then we go on and we start with the book of Shmot. And interestingly, we're going to come back to this. The way the book of Shmot opens up tells us something that we don't really need to know at this point because we already know it. We've heard it several times, and that is on verse 1 through verse 6. We have a listing of all of the people who came down. So let's start there. Lynn, would you like to read on page 293, verses 1 through 5?
Sure. And these are the names of the children of Israel who are coming to Egypt with Jacob. Each man and his household came: Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan and Naphtali, Gad and Asher. And all the persons who emerged from Jacob's loins were 70 souls, and Joseph was in Egypt.
Okay, great. So now we know, what do we now know? Who came down to Egypt? 70 people and the 12 tribes, basically, Jacob's 12 sons. Okay, so the question is, why do we need to know this? Because we just saw in Parshas Vayechi, when Jacob goes through the blessings of all of the children, we already know they're there because we went through the whole thing. Plus, we also know because they were listed when they first came down to Egypt, we're also told that they are there. So it's like this is the third time we're being told. And we also see that it's interesting because it's in the present tense. It says habayim, those who are coming. It doesn't say that they came down to Egypt. And all these people are no longer alive. So it's redundant that we don't need to know because we already know. And it's a little bit after the fact, and it's stating it in the present tense because really they already came a long time ago, and now we are many, many years in the future forward now. Susan. Mm-hmm. She's one of the 70. So this is like the tribes, but Dina is not counted as a tribe. So these were the tribes, what we call the tribes of Israel, the 12 sons of Jacob. But yes, Dina and all of the family members, 70 in all is what the count was, including Dina. Okay, so this is kind of strange, and we're going to come back to this because, as we know again, the Torah is not here to tell us history, it's here to teach us, and there's something that's being conveyed through just the very enumeration of the people's names who came down to Egypt. So we know that the imprisonment, the enslavement in Egypt was very challenging, and they were all sorts of decrees that rose up over the Jewish people. And when they talk about how it was that we suffered, we want to take a look at chapter 1, verse 13, and it gives a description of what some of the suffering was like. So on page 295, verse 13, and Patricia, would you like to read that for us? Verse 13, the Egyptians.
The Egyptians enslaved the children of Israel with crushing harshness. They embittered their lives with hard work, with mortar and with bricks, and with every labor of the field. All their labors that they performed with them were with crushing harshness.
Okay. So the description here, when it says Vayimaruru, and they embittered them and their lives, and it says Ba'avodah Kasha, which means hard work. So there's another meaning of the word kasha, which means if anybody's used to hearing at the Seder, when we have the four questions, what are those called? The kashas, okay? A kasha is a question. So another way of understanding this, and one of the commentators brings this down, is that they were plagued with kashas, with questions. and that that was what was so difficult. And what were the questions that made it so difficult while they were being oppressed? Is that they had the questions that people always have or frequently have when they are suffering. What are the questions that people have?
Why is this happening to me?
Where is God? Is there God? All of these things. This was a crisis of faith as much as it was a crisis of actual enslavement and challenge and oppression and all the hardship. Because people can go through many difficulties if they don't have those kinds of doubts. If you know that your pain is for a purpose, you don't have those questions. If you see a bigger picture, you don't have those doubts. So this was considered an intellectual challenge to the Jewish people, a crisis of faith, and it was an avodah kasha. It was the service of questioning. And that was what was causing them more pain than anything. And because they had those kinds of questions, if you notice here, after this description of this horrible, oppressive, challenging enslavement that the Jewish people had, there is nary a word about any response from the Jewish people turning to God in prayer or asking, seeking out God or crying out to God at all. It says that their mouths were silenced, said that they were intellectually and spiritually paralyzed. They were not able to respond, and they didn't really say anything. They were consumed with their doubts and with their crisis of faith, and they did not turn to God at that time. Lynn.
Were they also people who knew the times?
Let's see. That is a good question. At the beginning, yes, because there was a very slow process that the oppression started out as a public works project, and the Jews were like, okay, we're on this, like we're so Egyptian, we're here. And then Pharaoh even showed up, according to the Midrash, that Pharaoh shows up and he's like cuts the ribbon for the project, and then the next day he doesn't actually show up, and then pretty soon no one else is showing up except the Jews, and then pretty soon it's like you must come, and it was a gradual process of enslavement. So yes, it was not a quick blow. That happened at a period of time after things had been very good and then it became bad. So people had gotten kind of used to it in some way because it was a slow process. But there was when the hardship then comes, they are not seeing the picture of what's going on, and there is this crisis of faith. So the Jewish people were in exile in Egypt, and it says what was in exile? It says their intellect, their da'at, their knowledge of God was in exile, and the power of their mouths, that their mouths became almost unable to articulate and to connect with their neshamas, their souls, to be able to express themselves and call out to God. So this is a big problem, obviously, because this is what the Jewish people are all about, calling out to God. Going back to Yaakov and Esav, when Jacob dresses up as Esau and goes into Isaac for the blessing, to get the blessing, and Isaac cannot tell the difference between Jacob and Esau, he says, what does he say, the famous words is that the voice is the voice of Jacob, but the hands are the hands of Esau. And that Kol Yaakov, that voice of Jacob, is understood to be not just the voice of that man named Jacob, but to mean that the voice and the ability to speak and to call out in prayer and supplication and to be in communication with God, that is the essence of Yaakov, that's the essence of Jacob. There are some prayer books, not this one, that are called Kol Yaakov, the voice of Jacob. That's the edition is called the voice of Jacob. The power of the Jewish people is in prayer, in communication, and being in relationship with God. In this case, the people says that they can't even speak out because of this. The kasha, the questions they have, makes it kasha, makes it difficult for them, and it makes a heaviness for them in the realm of speaking. This should kind of ring a bell for us of heaviness of speech. Does anybody... Moshe at the burning bush, what does he say to Hashem? And let's just skip to that for a moment, and we'll see how he describes himself. That when he's saying to God, I can't be the one to be the leader. And what does he say about it? Hold on one sec. I'm sorry. 309, and we are on. Hold on a second. Thank you. And verse here on verse 10. So let's see what it says that Moshe replies to Hashem. And Kay, why don't you read that for us?
Moses replied to Hashem, "Please, my Lord, I am not a man of words, not since yesterday, nor since the day before yesterday, nor since you first spoke to your servant, for I am heavy of mouth and heavy of speech.
Well, first of all, I want to just point out that for somebody who's heavy of speech, he has a lot to say about how he can't speak. It's like, thou dost protesteth too much. Okay, so that he has a heavy speech here. And so then Hashem has an interesting answer, which we will also come back to. But what is Hashem's response to him? And Rachel, why don't you continue in verse 11 and 12?
Then Hashem said to him, who makes a mouth for man, and who makes one dumb or deaf, or sighted or blind? Is it not I, Hashem? So now go, I shall be with your mouth and teach you what you should say.
Okay, so Hashem is saying, so I'm the one that gives the power of speech. If I want you to talk, you'll talk. And like, don't worry about it, and just go forward. He doesn't say, oh, Moshe, I feel really bad. You're right, it's really a challenge for you. He's like, just get going, I'll be with you, and start talking. And then, just as an added aside, when we get to the Parsha of Devarim, of Deuteronomy, the entire book is called the Words of Moshe. This is not words that God commanded Moshe to say. So if we want to just skip ahead to that for a moment, we're just going to kind of take a look at a number of things here. If we go to the very beginning of Devarim, which is on page, hold on a second, my fingers are cold and they're not moving here. I'm sorry? Thank you. Page 939, the beginning of Parsha Devarim. And let's see what it says here. Verse 1 here. And let's see. Ronnie, would you like to read that?
These are the words that Moses spoke to all Israel on the other side of the Jordan concerning the wilderness, concerning the Arba, opposite the Sea of Reeds, between Paran and Tophet. And
as they wrote in Dizahab. Oh, okay.
11 days from Horeb by way of Mount Seir to Kadesh
Barnea. Okay, great. These are the words that Moshe spoke. It says the entire book of Devarim. It says, how long did he speak? It says there's a hint to it in the word Elah, Devarim, that the gematria, the numerical equivalent of the word Elah, let's figure this out. Aleph is equal to 1. Lamed is equal to 30. And hey is equal to 5. So what does that equal? 36. It said he talked for 36 days straight. Now, even someone who's very articulate and eloquent would probably be hard-pressed. So it says Moshe goes from being this person who is heavy of speech to the man doesn't stop talking. Plus, the entire Torah is Moshe speaking to the Jewish people, just even a little bit, a fraction of what it is that God has told us. So how did this happen? So this idea is that his heaviness of speech was really not just about him. It was that he was talking about that he was suffering from the same, you could say, the same spiritual illness as the Jewish people who were in Egypt, who were also heavy of speech, who were also unable to articulate, who could not bring themselves to be able to say anything, that he was, it was actually an expression of his feeling the pain and suffering of the Jewish people, even though by this time he had been in Midian for 40 years. He had married Zipporah, he was there for 40 years, and now God's speaking to him. He's feeling the suffering, the impact of the Jewish people and their suffering. When we get to the holiday that celebrates our exodus from Egypt, what is that holiday that everybody knows? Pesach. So the word Pesach is understood to be a conjunction of two words, peh, which means mouth, and sach, from the word siach, which means to speak. The speaking mouth holiday. And the primary mitzvah that we have of Pesach, that we are obligated to, what are we all obligated to do? We are obligated to speak that story. V'higadat lahem. You are obligated to tell that story, and we're even told, even if, unfortunately, it shouldn't happen to anybody, even if you are all by yourself, at a Pesach Seder, and you're sitting there with your matzah and your maror and everything else, you can't just read about the Exodus from Egypt. You can't just think about it. You must tell yourself the story and speak it out loud. And we're told, and the longer someone expounds on it, the better. Hare zeh meshubach. That person is praiseworthy. So we're saying, in Egypt, it was a place, a house of bondage. What was in bondage? It wasn't just our bodies. It was our spirits were in bondage as well. Our power of speech, that which makes us the Jewish people, was like molasses. You know, just kind of like talking like that. And but it was at a spiritual realm as well. And so we have the antidote for that, which is the exodus from Egypt, that freeing, that liberation. And when we get to Pesach, then we spend that time telling the story and speaking about everything that God did and praising. And it is the opposite of that. In the Kabbalah, every Hebrew month has a spiritual quality that is associated with it. And the month of Nisan, which is when Pesach occurs, is the spiritual quality of speech. So that idea of speaking is the redemption. It's called the tikkun of the peh. Its speech is going to be returned to you. So when God says this, it's not just, I'm going to do you a favor, you had, you know, you haven't been in speech therapy for a while, but I'll be here for you. He's saying at all levels, God is the one who gives us all of our powers, but our goal is to be the ones who speak out. Even in our davening, before we start the Shmona Esrei, which is the central part of our davening, the Amida, that there is a phrase that we say beforehand, which is Adonai Sefatai Tiftach, God, open up my mouth, Ufi Yagid Tehilatecha, and my mouth will speak your praises. We've been davening, so now I'm asking God, what was I doing during the first part of Shachri? During Pasukei Dezimra, I was also speaking. But we're saying that the gift of speech and to be articulate is ultimately a gift from God, and it is our power of speech that when we speak to God that brings us into relationship. Just like any good relationship, how do we know when somebody is kind of on the outs with somebody, what do they stop doing? I'm not talking to him. You know? It's like that's how we show that there's the relationship, there's a problem. So it's like talking means that you are in relationship. Even if there's a problem, as long as there's talking about it and you are in communication, the relation, there's hope. If there's no talking, then we have a big problem. Susan.
Well, if speech is a gift from God, then Moses was given the gift by God, then why didn't God give that gift to the people
that they'd be able to have that? You have to want it. You have to want out. And the way we express the desire to want it is to cry out. So the word, when someone cries, how much verbalization is there in that? There's not. Someone's crying. It's almost like it's coming from the gut. It's almost like saying, it's beyond words. I cried out is talking about something that doesn't yet have words. But if someone cries out, then they can be given the gift of speech. They didn't cry out. And they don't cry out until, hold on 1 second, now we'll go back to our parsha, to page 301. And this was, 80 years later, they're finally crying out. Okay, so let's do this here. So verse 23 here. And Susan, why don't you read that for us?
I'm sorry, what was
it? Page 301, verse 23.
During those many days, it happened that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel groaned because of the work, and they cried out. Their outcry because of the work went up to God.
Okay.
God heard their moaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God saw the children of Israel, and God knew.
Okay. What is it God knew? It's like God knew the whole time. It wasn't like God needed like, oh, now I heard word. Now I got words. Like when you cry out, the act of crying out is what triggers the relationship of everything to start in again. Because the whole point is to be in relationship. When they cry out, and this cry is like a sa'aka, it's a groaning that it's not even articulate. It says that means they're ready for redemption. The act of crying out is what starts the process. So what are we supposed to do when we personally have problems or something that is challenging us or is overwhelming us or a difficulty? What are we supposed to do? We're supposed to cry out. We're not supposed to say, oh, I have a stiff upper lip. I'm just going to deal with it. You know, I shouldn't cry out. It's like, even if we can't verbalize or articulate what we need, the first thing to do is to cry out. And then the act of crying out, and sometimes that happens, is when people cry out and there's tears, that then afterwards there's like a catharsis that happens that actually then enables a person to verbalize their feelings and to then be in relationship and connect with God. Lynn, you look very concerned by this.
It says God remembered. It presumes God forgot.
Okay, so God's remembering is not about forgetting. So God's remembering is like when we say Yisker, when we say Yisker to remember when someone has passed away, it's not that we forgot them. Zachor in the manner of God always means to do something about it. So same thing when we make Kiddush, it's called Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim, a remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt. It wasn't like I forgot about it until Friday evening. It means now I'm going to do something about it. So that's a very good point. So God doesn't forget. So God doesn't forget, but God's remembering means, we have the same thing when it says God remembered Sarah. You know, and then she became pregnant. It's like he didn't forget about her. It was like it was time for then something to happen. So remembering also always means triggering an action that's going to now get something started. And he remembered his covenant. It's now time to activate the covenant he made with Abraham, which was your children will be strangers in a strange land for 400 years, and then I will take them out with an outstretched arm, and they will come out and have wealth, and they will be redeemed. So it's like, okay, now it's time. What were we waiting for? We were waiting for the Jewish people to cry out. And so sometimes, but we said before that they were in a place of spiritual doubt, intellectualization, they were in a different place in their heads and they couldn't cry out. So the challenge is, and the paradox is when we feel ourselves having questions arise, why is God doing this to me? What did I do to deserve this? How could this happen? Is there even a God? What kind of a God would even do this? It says that place is called the Avodah Kasha. That's the place where we're in our heads and have these questions that burden us and they lock our mouths. It says the antidote for that is now's the time to pray. Now's the time to call out and start praying. We tend to think, if I had faith, then I would pray. Our equation is the opposite. When you pray, you will gain faith. When you call out and when you articulate and start the dialogue and having the conversation going, that actually triggers the what's called the seed of emunah, the seed of faith and trust that is embedded in every Jewish person. It may be down to like a little tiny barely flickering flame. The act of calling out and the act of expression, the act of prayer, is considered something that will ignite that and then fill us with and be ready then to start the relationship in a different direction, and it triggers miraculous things to happen. So this is what was going on in Egypt, and excuse me, so they cried out. Then everything starts happening. Moshe is sent, and he's basically told, don't worry, you'll be speaking fine. And the truth is, it wasn't just at Devarim, when we get to Deuteronomy at the end of 40 years of being in the desert, that Moshe is speaking. He's speaking once he gets to Egypt. He goes into Pharaoh. He's talking. He's even handling, what do they say, people fear public speaking is like second to death, you know. So given that he was saying, I can't speak, that we're not really talking about having a speech impediment as we are talking about having an intellectual impediment, a spiritual impediment that is slowing, being tongue-tied in that way is I can't verbalize. So, excuse me, God is saying, I'm with you and I'm with your mouth, and don't worry, you're going to be speaking just fine. So it's very interesting in that way. So then, excuse me, finally, when they do cry out, this is 80 years, because Moshe is 80 when he is sent on his mission. This is for people who think that when they turn 80 that maybe, you know, they should just sail off into the sunset. It's like, no, that's when the best is yet to come. When the Jewish people were in Egypt that whole time, they had something that was accessible to them, which was the power of prayer. And when we talk about prayer, people say, like, so what kind of prayer? What should I be praying for? What should I say? So part of it is just informal prayer of just verbalizing exactly what it is we need and what it is we want. And then we always ask God to answer our prayers for our good. Meaning, I may be asking for something that may not really be a good idea or may not really fit in with what God's plan is for the universe. And I want to play my role, whatever that is. So prayer is both a combination of wanting to understand what God's role is and what God's plan is, and I want to fit into it. So again, it's like having a meeting in a company. You want to know, what's the mission of the company? I don't want to just ask for, you know, I want a budget of $100,000 and I want 50 people to work for me and I want this, I want this, I want that. It's like, well, actually, the goal of the company right now is we're downsizing. So that request doesn't really go with what we're doing. Or we're streamlining, or we're moving the company to another country. We don't know. If we don't know what the plan is, then it's very hard to ask for what it is we want. So when we ask for what we want, we always want to ask for it within the context of what's the overall plan, because basically I want to be part of the plan. So that's one aspect of it. But there's another aspect of prayer, which I've always kind of been involved with kind of, but not fully, and that is the power of Psalms, the power of Tehillim. Psalms are considered the absolute best, what's called, weapon that the Jewish people have, bless you, against our enemies, against any travails or challenges or crises that we're going through, whether it is individually, in our community, our family, collectively, throughout the world, is to recite Psalms. And it's interesting because the Psalms, first of all, they're beautiful. They're very difficult, I think. The Hebrew is very flowery. Who wrote the Psalms? So King David wrote most of the Psalms, but not all of the Psalms. He wrote many of them, but he also compiled ones that had been written before. So the first Psalm that was ever composed is a Psalm I passed out to you. And that Psalm is Psalm 92, which was understood to be composed by Adam, Harishon. And it was understood that he says this psalm, he creates this psalm, in response to finding out, again, according to the Midrash, that it says that after Cain killed Abel, that Adam sees Cain walking around. So you'd think like that God would have killed Cain also for having killed Abel. But he's walking around, and Adam says to Cain, like, so what happened? What was your judgment? Like, what happened? And the Cain says, well, God and I, like, worked out a deal. Because he said, like, oh, like, I didn't even think to do that from the sin of eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. Like, what do you mean? He said, I did teshuva. I repented, and God gave me life, and I will be able to live out my days. And Adam was like, I never even thought of that. And he says, and Mizmor Shir Leyom HaShabbat, a song for the Sabbath day, and it says that this is the psalm that comes out of his mouth, and that this is the psalm that we sing. This is the psalm that we sing every Shabbos that we do, and you can also do it any time, so that's why I Xeroxed it for us, because this could be, if you want to connect yourself to the very first psalm. And so the question is, like, what's so powerful about psalms? So we're going to talk about that for a moment. First of all, many psalms, they're all called, if you've heard the word Zmirot for Shabbos, Zemer is different than the word Shira. Okay, Shira also means a song. So what's the difference between Zmirot and a Shira? No one says, oh, let's sing some Shabbos Shirim. We don't ever use that word. We say Zmirot. I'm sorry? There are special psalms and songs that are created to praise God, but says that the word mizmor, which means like a song or a psalm, that the whole book of Psalms are called the Zmirot, that the King David wrote, says that of all of his qualities, that he was a great king, all the amazing things he did, but that his best appellation is that he's called the sweet singer of psalms, that's the main thing he did. Those psalms, so the word mizmor is related, or a zemer, is related to the word zamar. And a zamar means to prune, okay? Like if you're pruning your garden, to cut away that which is unnecessary. So in our davening, for example, in the morning, we have the first part of our davening is called Pesukei Dezimra, verses of psalms, of praise. But they're really understood to be verses of pruning. And what's our first task when we get up in the morning before we start in our davening is, let's just prune away all the unnecessary stuff, because what happens when you prune something well is then you enable it to really grow and to really flourish. So the act of pruning, you never have something, even if you know you have a plant or something, you think, oh, this plant looks like it's really gone, but then you cut away, bless you, the kind of the dead stuff, and then you see that it actually triggers new growth in the parts that are doing well. So that's kind of an interesting thing that just works even at the biological level or the botanical level with plants. It says the same thing is true with us, that before, if we want to grow and we want to be spiritually elevated, the first thing we need to do is to have a daily pruning process. And the daily pruning process is almost exclusively psalms. If you look at Pasuke de Zimra, there's psalms. That's what we're reciting. So it's like, so how, why does that work? So that's the power that has been invested in psalms, is the power to do that, regardless of whether you know what you're saying or not. It's like you could be pruning and you don't, you don't have to know how the pruning process works and understand what happens, why the plant then takes off in a new and healthier way, to know that it works. The best example I heard that was beautifully given is the pruning of rose bushes. That it looks so counterintuitive that you keep, when they first, you keep pruning and pruning and pruning them. If you were the rose bush, you would say, hey, you know, what are you doing to me? Like, just let me grow. It's like, I do want you to grow. That's why I'm going to prune you. And so the pruning process is the process that allows something to really flourish the most beautifully. So that is the power of psalms and those zmirot that we have. And being involved in saying psalms every day is considered, it says, will ward off the negative forces. It says, what's being pruned? It says, negative forces are pruned through the power of Tehillim. It's like, what negative forces? Whatever negative forces there are. Personal negative forces in your life, it can be changed so that that which is healthy, that which is good, and that can be grow and flourish, that will strengthen that. And that's the best way, is to prune away that which is bad so that that which is good can flourish. Susan.
Can you do that for somebody else?
Yes.
Say, in your psalm?
Absolutely.
There
are. I have a book, I have a listing of psalms that are ones that are specific for certain occasions. That being said, any and all psalms. It's the act of reciting psalms. It says that somebody who recites the psalms, some people recite the entire book of psalms every day. It's considered the same as if you studied the entire Torah. It has that much weight to it.
We say Tehillim for people who are very sick.
Yes, we do. We say Tehillim, and I'm part of a Tehillim circle, that we the entire book of Tehillim amongst the women in the community, I don't even know who all is in it, we signed up. So I recite Psalm 92, 93, and 94 every single day. And that's and so that the entire book of Tehillim is recited by this group of women every single day. For and then there's a list. It's called, and then we have a little thing. I don't even know the people on the list. So one person keeps a list of people's Hebrew names. And we just refer to the list indirectly. It says, for all the people who are on this list. I don't even know who they are. And it doesn't matter. I don't need to know. And then I add people in who aren't on that list, who I didn't email the person to say, put this person on the list. So I add people as well. And it's for everything. It's for parnasa, for livelihood. It's to find a mate. It is for success of your children. It is to become pregnant. It is to be healed from illnesses. It's to be anything that is needed, like anything that is an impediment. So that's what we understand, that all impediments can be dealt with as if it's like a bush that of life that is out of control, and that we prune it by pruning that which is negative so that which is positive can flourish. And that's called zmirot. Those are the mizmor. So any of the Tehillim fulfill that purpose. Being involved with them on a daily basis is considered to be an incredibly powerful way for the Jewish people to impact creation and to impact all levels of reality. And it seems like you have to, I think it's an expression of faith to say, seriously, I feel like I should write a letter to the editor, to my congressman, I have to do something. It's like, you do need to do something, and to prune away the negative forces that all these things kind of come from requires the reciting of psalms. And this is a process, too, that we use for ourselves during the process of teshuvah. So during the month of Elul, from Rosh Chodesh Elul until Yom Kippur, when we are heightening our efforts to do teshuva and return to our true selves and to kind of prune away the actions, the attitudes, the behaviors, whatever it is that we've done that has gotten us off track. And you can kind of picture yourself. I mean, maybe we could even like draw a picture of our life as a bush. It's like, well, here's when I went off like there, and like I'm not sure what kind of thing came from that branch. I think we better prune it back to get to the root of who we really are, so that that which is truest to us can flourish. It says during that time, those days between Rosh Chodesh Elul and Yom Kippur is considered especially auspicious time to recite psalms. That Tehillim and Teshuvah are all wrapped together. Now we're going to go to the beginning of the Parsha of Shemot and see a hint to this in the opening words of the Parsha. And for this, I need my little notes here. Yes?
At morning, is it all said at one specific time of the day?
You can say them whenever you want, wherever you want.
So is there more power in there, in this group, saying everyone say them at 9:30 Eastern Standard? What matter?
Just within the 24 hours. Now, that being said, when there is a huge crisis, Jewish people do come together and recite Tehillim as a group all at one time, and it concentrates the energy even more. Okay. So one thing that is related to the idea of how do Zmirot, these Zemers, get connected to Teshuvah through an interesting word connection is we understand like the root of all error that we make is the Yetzer Hara, the evil inclination, which is considered to be embodied by the Nachash, the snake that was the tempting force in the Garden of Eden. So the Nachash, it says, that is what's at the root of everything. And so what's the antidote to a Nachash? It says, if you take the letters of Nachash, which are Nun is the Na, Chet, and Shin, that's how you spell Nachash, and you take the letter that comes right before each of those letters. So this may be a little, we're going to unscramble these. So the letter that comes right before Nun of Nachash is the letter Mem. So just remember the M sound. The letter that comes right before the Chet of Nachash is Zion, the Z sound. And the letter that comes right before Shin is Resh, which is an R. So you have the Mzra, okay, Zemer. It's, you just unscramble it, Z-M-R instead of M-Z-R. Okay, so it's Zemer. It says, what's the antidote to the force of the Nachash, the force of negativity and things that pull us off track, is Zemer, is the force of Zmirot, the force of Tehillim. It says, saying Tehillim prunes away and pulls back and gets rid of the negative forces that are around us as individuals as well as the rest of the world. There is a interesting phrase in Genesis, in Bereshit, when God gives the Nachash his punishment. It says, the man will crush your head. Okay? Now, last time we checked, when was it really seemed like a good idea to step on a snake's head? So it's like, that's not such a good idea. That sounds pretty dangerous. What do you mean we're going to crush their head? It says, we're going to crush their head. It says, we're going to use the letters that are ahead of your name to crush the power that you have. What are the letters that are ahead of your name? The letters that come before the Nun, before the Chet, before the Shin, the Zemer. It says, Zmirot, those Mizmorim, those psalms, are going to crush the head of the snake. Otherwise, not really great advice to say that we're going to crush the head of a snake, because most of us are not going to do that. But that's what we're talking about, the force there. Okay, so as we said, this is the primary force, the power of the Jewish people. We see a reference to this. Again, we're going to look at some Hebrew letters. If you go to page 292, the beginning of the Parsha, if you take the first five words in the Hebrew, it's Ve'ela Shemot B'nei Yisrael Habaim. And these are the names of the Jewish, of the children of Israel who were coming. Again, we said that's kind of weird. Why does it say this anyway? Instead of taking the first letter of each of these words, we're going to look at the last letter of each of these words. So the last letter of the word Ve'ela is He. The last letter of the word Shemot is Tav. The last letter of the word B'nai is Yud. The last letter of the word Yisrael is Lamed. And the last letter of the word habayim is mem. Unscramble those letters. What word do you have? Tehillim. Okay, it says Tehillim. And what was the power of these Tehillim? Take the next five words that are the same as this part of this same sentence, and we're going to have Mitzrayma ed Yaakov ish uveto ba'u. Again, we said, why are you telling us this? We don't need to know this. We already know this. It's like, you need to know this because there's something, there's a message, there's a hint in here for you of what the power is of the Jewish people and what the whole thing is all about. You take the last letter of the word Mitzrayma, and it is hey. The last letter of the word eight is tough. The last letter of the word Yaakov is vet. The last letter of the word ish is shin. And uveto is vav. Okay, that you put that together of those words, and we have hey, tough, vet, shin, vav, and it's the word teshuvah. Okay, so the word teshuvah and tehillim are linked together in this opening verse. It says, what am I sending you down into Egypt with? I'm telling you, what is going to protect you and help you is going to be the power of teshuvah to be activated and woken up through the power of saying tehillim. It says, and the Jews had tehillim. They had tehillim that were available to them. Which tehillim did they have? This one. They had this Tehillim. They could say this. They could study this. There's also Tehillim that were written by Avraham. There's also Tehillim that was written by Melchizedek, who was Noach's son, Shem. So they already had some Tehillim that were there. King David later wrote more. In fact, Moshe wrote it. So there's a whole bunch of them that are written by Moshe. We say the Mizmor Shir, written by Moshe Ish HaElohim, the man of God. So Tehillim is really a compendium of Tehillim that were written not just by King David, even though he wrote most of them, but also going back to Adam, and that the Jewish people had access to this, and this is what helped them through the times, because even though they were in this place where they couldn't cry out, they weren't completely muted. They weren't completely non-responsive, because we know there were Jewish people at the end of 210 years who had survived and who had thrived and were still able to identify themselves as being Jewish, who were still in relationship with God. It's just that things were at just a very low level. We know that things were at a low level because what do we learn that the Jewish people, which level did they reach of spiritual impurity? 49th level of spiritual impurity. So there happens to be a lot of different 49s. Another 49, it says, when someone reaches the 49th level of spiritual impurity, that means that they need to go through a 49-step process of spiritual purity, which is called purification, which is called teshuva. That's the process, is to get into, if you've gone down to this path, then your path out is to go through the 49 steps, the 49 gates is what they are called, the 49 gates of teshuva. So it's the Jewish people, this was the phrase that Rabbi Wagner Hagensburg coined. He says, we could call ourselves the 49ers, that we are all about the 49. Everything is about 49. Because after we leave Egypt, what do? Again, we go through a 49-step process. That is the counting of the Omer, Sfirat HaOmer, 49 days between the leaving of Egypt and getting to Mount Sinai. Mount Sinai was not 49 days away from Egypt. It wasn't like, oh, well, we happened to have gotten there, and it was the 49th day. It happened to be just that. It's like, it was just a few days away. Even with all those people moving, who knows, that could take a long time. But it wasn't a 49-day journey. It was a 49-day journey. It was a 49-day journey to holiness. And then what happens on the 50th day, which we celebrate as Shavuot, is like God provides the final step that completes the process. So it's always 49 and then the 50th. On the 50th is when God responds. So who has to act first? We do. And the prophet says, you know, God speaking to the Jewish people, return to me and then I will return to you. But who has to trigger the relationship? We do. So it's not God is only going to do so much. We have to be the ones to initiate. And then 50th, that's when God comes. So just keep your page here, but we're going to go back again to God's response to Moshe when he says that he is that he's not going to be able to speak and that his mouth isn't working. So if you want to go back to page 309, when it says on verse 11, when God says, Then Hashem said to him, who makes a mouth for man, or who makes one dumb, or deaf, or sighted, or blind? But in response, when it says, who makes a mouth for man, the word for who is me. The numerical equivalent of me is, mem is equal to 40, and yud is equal to 10, bringing us to 50. So he's saying, 50, sam peh la'adam, on the 50th day, on the 50, when you hit 50, that's when I'm going to make your mouth really work, because that's going to be Mount Sinai, that's going to be the giving of Torah, and then we're going to see a mouth that not only can just speak normally, it's going to be a mouth of prophecy. So the 50th is when that kicks in. But you need to do the 49-step program first. So now again, back to page 293, a beautiful connection. We said before that it didn't really make so much sense that we are again given the names of each of the tribes, because we already knew that before when they come down to be reunited with Joseph. We already know that they were there because Jacob gave him a blessing. And we also had the question of why is it saying it in the present tense, Habayim? Well, first of all, we already discovered we need that mem, because it needs to be part of the word Tehillim, of what's coming to accompany the Jewish people in their power of Teshuvah, and what they should use to access that. But now we are going to go to the names. So it happens that if you count all the letters in the names of each of the sons of Jacob, and not the vav or something that means v or u, which also means and, but just the actual letters of their names, starting with Reuven. And so even if you don't read Hebrew, let's just count those up. So Reuven is, we'll just count that, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 letters in Reuven, and then Shimon 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, Levi 11, 12, 13. Skip the V for Yehuda, because that just means and. Where were we at? What number? But which number were we at? 13. 14, 15, 16, 17, 18. Yisachar, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23. 24, 25, 26, 27, 28. Skip the U. 29, 30, 31, 32, 33. Dan, 34, 35. Naphtali, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40. God, 41, 42, Asher, 43, 44, 45, and then Yosef is in the next verse, Yosef, 46, 47, 48, 49. How many letters are in all of B'nai Israel? 49. It says, the 49ers are coming down with you, the 49 steps, the path to Teshuvah. The way you're going to keep this relationship going is accessing this power of the Jewish people to speak, the power of the Jewish people to cry out. And when do you cry out? Specifically when you start having all these questions. One doesn't say, well, if I had more faith, then I would talk to God. The fact, if a Jewish person isn't feeling faith, that's the signal to cry out to God. Even to say, I'm not having any faith. Give me some. Like, light my fire in there. My little flicker of emunah is really collapsing here. I need more. It says, what is the fuel for that fire? Are the zmirot, the zemer, to prune away the negativity and let me flourish here. It says, I'm sending this down with you. I don't need to know that the names of the people who came in. I don't need to know, especially this weird grammar that you're telling me, that they're coming in as if they just came and it's already hundreds of years later. But I do need to know, how am I supposed to survive in the oppression that is going to be going on in Egypt, which is serving its own process, its own purpose, and for me to be able to recognize that, yes, this is painful. And it says specifically that how did Pharaoh treat them? It says that he embittered them. So bitterness just tells you how it tastes or how it feels to us. It's not a judgment. It's not saying it was bad or that it was wrong. It's just saying it was very bitter, that the enslavement in Egypt was very bitter. But the enslavement in Egypt was considered one of the most purposeful, necessary, needed, profound, beneficial things that the Jewish people ever went through, ever. That's why we're supposed to remember it every day. It's not just, oh, remember you were slaves. Like, remember that process, because that whole process was considered a pruning process. The whole thing was designed to create a Jewish people that has lasted till right now. The fact that we're sitting in this room together, this shows the power of what that experience did. So we are stamped with that experience of the Exodus from Egypt. How many times in the Torah is the Exodus from Egypt referred to? It says 50 times. If you look throughout the entire Torah, there are 50 references to the experience in Egypt. Those were the gates that the Jewish people had to go through. So maybe, you know, if you, I remember seeing that movie, was it called Top Gun or something? The training that they go through to be, what do they turn into at the end?
Pilots.
The grueling. Now, if somebody just snatched you up off the street and put you through that, you would file charges of, I don't know, what against them? Torture, imprisonment, assault. You would say something. How is it that when we understand that somebody's going through a training program in order to be prepared for something more, there's competition to get into that. People want to get into that because they know that the whole training process is going to take them to a level where they're going to be capable of doing something more profound than they were able to do before. But if we just see it, it's like, wow, this is terrible, and why is God doing this to me? It's like, I'm trying to train you. I'm trying to help you. The process is bitter. I'm not going to say that. The training program is hard. Boot camp is hard. I talked to my daughter-in-law when her brother was in the IDF. He was like in the special forces. It's very competitive. And what they had to do and carrying the, I don't know, 200-pound backpacks and hiking up the mountain and go down and this and sleep in the cold and you have to sleep in the mud or do whatever. It's like, if you didn't know you were in training camp, you'd say, God, why are you doing this to me? It's like, I'm training you. So the Jewish people were being trained. Egypt is called the crucible that purified and got the Jewish people to a place where we would be able to access our deepest emunah, our deepest faith, and our greatest qualities. When we talk about the burning bush, one of the things that Moshe sees that he's surprised by, and let's just take a look at that here, because I think it will give us an image, is when he sees the bush, page 301, chapter 3, verses 2 and 3. And so let's read that. Vera, do you want to read verses 2 and 3 on page 301?
An angel of God appeared to him in a blaze of fire from amid the bush. He saw, and behold, the bush was burning in the fire, but the bush was not consumed. Moses thought, I will turn aside now and look at this great sight. Why will the bush not be burned?
So what was what was the thing that was most surprising to him? It wasn't being consumed, but it was on fire. Now you could say, wouldn't you just be mostly surprised that there was a bush burning in the middle of something? So the bush burning and not being consumed said, this is the image of the Jewish people. They can be burned and not consumed and not destroyed. But it's a burning process, it's like a smelting process. So if anyone, and I learned this from a friend of mine and I read this too, I thought it was really interesting, in the process of the purification of silver. So it's like that whole process of removing the impurities, like how do you know when the silver is done? So the silversmith, it's a quote, I don't know if it's like Midrash or whatever, when he can see himself in it, then it's done. When the reflection is pure, then it's done. It says, that's how God knew, is when will the Jewish people be done with this process, the smelting process? When I see myself, the vision, image of God in those people, then they're done. And there's a process. You can go too far. If you go too far, then it's ruined. But you go to the right amount. So that's why the Jewish people had to reach the 49th level. You say, God, why don't you take them out like at level 30 or something? They seriously had to go through all 49? So it's just like a plant that is a seed that is germinating. The seed has to actually decompose, and then it starts to flourish. If you take it out and you say, oh, you know, that seed's been in there long enough, poor thing, you know, it's decomposing, I think I'll take it out now, you have no plant, or you have some sort of plant that's not going to grow right. So the Jewish people had to go through this process, not because God was trying to torture them, because God was trying to help them. It was the promise to Abraham, when he is told, your descendants will be strangers in a strange land for 400 years, and then I will take them out. Abraham doesn't pray at that point to say, no, don't do that. He doesn't say anything. And yet we know if he felt that someone was being punished, like the people of Sodom and Gomorrah, he speaks right up and says, no, don't do that. How could you do that to the people who are righteous? But here he's being given a prophecy about the Jewish people, and it doesn't elicit a response from him. It's like, this is a promise. It's not a threat. And so sometimes when we are in difficult situations, we see it as a threat to us when really it's a promise. God is saying, in case we didn't know, what I never promised you, a rose garden. God did promise us a rose garden, actually. A rose garden that would be pruned. A rose garden where we would be cut away. A rose garden where we could truly flourish and become beautiful. The power of this is in the power of Tehillim, the power of Psalms, and having just even one psalm to add to your day. It takes about 90 seconds to read it, English or Hebrew. Something that's a very powerful part of the Jewish people, and you can attach to it. You can attach to it. And some books of Tehillim have the prayer that is said before the reciting of Tehillim, which you can also find and to use to talk about that this should have the merit of the entire Torah, and it should have the merit of protection and salvation and everything. It should just be a zamar. It should just be a pruning of all negativity in the entire world, however it's impacting us, ourselves personally, myself with myself, myself with other people, myself and my situation. Whatever it is, the power of Tehillim has that power. So that we, just like the Jewish people who went down into Egypt, they were accompanied with, I'm sending you down here with the power of Tehillim. That is your path to Teshuvah. You will be able to endure the 49 challenges I'm going to give you, and that is your path up through them to redemption, and I will catch you at the 50th level. And you just keep coming up, and I will meet you there. So God willing, we can understand and appreciate all the challenges we go through as truly opportunities, and that if we feel a crisis in faith and trust, that is, as they say, dafka the moment to start calling out, to not wait for the trust. The trust is waiting for the calling out. So God willing, we'll be strengthened by that. And I hope you have a wonderful Shabbos. If you're in shul on Shabbos, they'll be saying this. So you say, I know this one already that Adam Harishon brought to us. Yes, Susan.
What is a
re'im? It's an, I think it's an animal. Where are you? I don't know. King David, I have a whole book of commentary on Tehillim. It's fascinating to study. So as a person who involves themselves in the study of Tehillim, even that much higher, there's probably commentary. I have to say, I just say it, and I know a lot of the words, but not all of them the way King David writes. I will be in touch with all of you about plans for next week. For those who came in late, this building will be closed the next two Thursdays for long weekends. We're going to see if we can meet at the JCC in the Perlmutter room. If not, maybe Susan will check out and see if we can meet at Temple Emmanuel. But we will not have class for sure on January 9th because I'll be out of town. But hopefully next week and the week after, the 26th and the 2nd, we will be able to meet somewhere and bring the light of Torah to wherever we are. Have a wonderful Shabbos. Here on Shabbos, I'm sure it will be. I can't imagine it wouldn't be. I've never heard of that.